I worked for a tech startup outside San Francisco. I didn't make a lot of money, but my boss assured me that once the company unveiled its new products, my salary would triple. I've been there for 3 years, and they still kept telling me that the product launch was coming soon. I was starting to feel like they were just stringing me along. I didn't quit though, because I needed the paycheck. Plus, I was able to work from home, which was really important for me. My older sister Elizabeth was paralyzed from the neck down, so I had to be her caregiver when her nurse wasn't there. Elizabeth demanded constant attention, and her nurses never stayed with us longer than a few months. She was an extremely difficult patient, always shouting at her nurses and taking out all her frustrations on them. She was even worse to me. Sometimes I wished that she'd just die, but then I felt really guilty for the thought. One morning, I was spoon-feeding her breakfast when my boss Antonio texted me about a mandatory meeting. I cleaned up Elizabeth's face and then rushed over to my laptop. I expected the entire staff to be there, but it was just Antonio and me. He was the kind of person who never smiled, but that morning, he had a massive grin on his face. He told me that their product launch was finally going to happen. Just 1 month away, I knew this was amazing news, because that meant I'd finally have enough money to afford better full-time care for my sister. Antonio explained that there was still one more hurdle that we had to deal with. The product had only been tested in-house, so they needed one more trial from someone outside of the office, someone who would represent the average customer. Because I just worked in marketing, I had no contact with the development team. That made me the ideal candidate to test out the product. I tried to ask him what it actually did. After all, I'd worked for this company for years and I still wasn't told what they were developing. He refused to answer. He said that the whole point of this trial was that an outsider would be able to use their product without any negative effects. I really didn't have a choice. I wanted the company to succeed. I wanted the raise. So, I agreed. That afternoon, a small package arrived at my front door. Elizabeth was screaming at me at the time, so I almost didn't hear the doorbell. I rushed to get it and then opened it right away. Elizabeth demanded to know what I'd gotten, but I didn't want to tell her. Part of the trial was that I was sworn to secrecy, even with my sister. This made her mad. She screamed so loudly that I had to go outside for some peace and quiet. Sitting on my front stoop, I looked over the device, a small square with about 20 buttons. It looked extremely generic, like an old calculator. It came with a one-page manual. I guessed it was some kind of handheld projector, something to do with holograms. But when I read over the manual, I realized that it was something much, much better. The manual explained that the device was for memory tourism. By punching in the right code, I could be sent back to any point in my conscious life, which meant as far back as 5 years old. The experience would last for 3 minutes at a time. I quickly scanned over the warnings, none of which seemed all that important, and then I decided to do my first test. I typed in the date of my college graduation. I pressed the right buttons, and then waited. Nothing happened for about 5 seconds, and then my surroundings instantly disappeared. I was now back at my old school, surrounded by former classmates. It felt so real. I could feel the graduation robe hanging loosely over my body. I felt younger too, healthier. The constant headache that I'd had since I started taking care of Elizabeth full-time had completely disappeared. It was wonderful. I heard the dean call out my name and I proudly walked onto the stage. I remember tripping over my robes on the way up the stairs, so I tried to walk slowly. Thankfully, I didn't trip. I received my diploma and then looked out into the audience. I could see my parents and sister in the front row. But they weren't looking at me. Elizabeth was throwing another tantrum, and both my parents were trying to calm her down. They'd missed my big moment. I'd forgotten about that part. Everything faded away, and I was back to the present. I couldn't believe it. I just experienced the past exactly as it had happened. Then I realized it wasn't exactly the same. In real life, I had tripped, but in this memory, I stopped myself from tripping. I was able to change one little part. I looked down at the manual one more time. The very last warning at the bottom of the page said, "Do not change any of your past actions." Did that mean that I could literally change the past? Was it a memory machine or an actual time machine? I had to find out. I ran back inside. The living room was an absolute mess. In Elizabeth's latest fit, she'd managed to ram her motorized wheelchair into the table, knocking my laptop and all my papers onto the floor. "Now will you tell me what you got?" she asked. I didn't have time to be mad at her. I had to ask. "Did I trip during my graduation?" "What?" I asked her again. "When I was on stage getting my diploma, did I trip?" She refused to answer. She thought I was making fun of her for being in a wheelchair. It didn't matter. I cleaned up her mess and set my laptop aside, hoping that it wasn't completely broken. Then I raced into my bedroom to try the device again. I figured I could do an easy experiment to find out. I set the device to 2 weeks ago when I'd gone to the salon. Instantly, I was taken back to the hairdresser's chair. The woman asked me what I wanted, and I told her that I'd like to get red highlights. She tried to talk me out of it, but I insisted. This lasted for the whole 3 minutes. Then I was back in my bedroom. I looked in the mirror and saw that my hair now had red highlights. So it worked. I had actually changed the past after all. This machine was going to change the world. And I know exactly what I was going to do with it. The manual advised against traveling to any time before you were 5 years old, because memories aren't fully formed before that age. But I had to risk it. I had to go back to when I was 4, when Elizabeth had her paralyzing accident. I started the device, sending myself back to Elizabeth's 6th birthday party. We were near my uncle's empty pool. Elizabeth had wanted to impress me by jumping off the diving board and landing on an inflatable raft. That was how she became paralyzed. The horrible moment was seared into my memory. Just as I'd remembered, Elizabeth and I were racing toward the diving board. None of the adults were paying attention. But then, something strange happened. I stepped onto the diving board instead of Elizabeth. "Get off there!" she screamed. "I told you it wasn't safe." "I'll be fine," I told her. The words just came out of my mouth. I could feel the board creak under my feet. "No!" Elizabeth screamed. She ran toward me, trying to pull me off the board. She wrapped her arm around me, pulling me back. But in the process, she slipped off the edge and fell into the pool. I looked down and saw her lying there, her neck twisted to the side. That was when the memory ended. I was back in the present, struggling to catch my breath. Nothing made sense. Elizabeth chose to jump. That was how she hurt herself. She was showing off. It wasn't because she was trying to save me. Or was it? I started to cry. All this time, I thought that my sister had caused the accident herself. But I had misremembered the whole time. She was paralyzed because of me. Because she was trying to save me. I was too numb to move. Slowly, my bedroom door creaked open and Elizabeth powered her wheelchair into my room. She saw me sobbing on my bed. "I'm sorry about your computer," she said. "I didn't mean to break it." I looked up at her and asked, "What do you remember about your accident?" She didn't answer for a while. Then she said, "Nothing. It's all a blur. All I know is that I shouldn't have gone near that pool." I could tell that she was lying to me. She knew that she'd fallen because she was trying to save me. All this time, she never told me the truth. Elizabeth noticed the look on my face. "You remember it now, don't you? Did that machine help you remember? Why didn't you tell me?" "I was glad you blocked out the memory," she said. "When you were a kid, you were always so wild and reckless. I was so worried that you would hurt yourself. If I hadn't been there..." "I can fix it," I said. Before she could say anything else, I turned the device back on and went back to the past. Once again, Elizabeth and I were running toward the empty swimming pool. This time, I forced myself to skid to a halt. "Let's go back to the party," I said. Elizabeth looked surprised. You're sure? Yes, I said. It's dangerous. I know that now. And together, we walked back toward the adults. No one was getting hurt today. I was able to spend two precious moments enjoying my childhood once more before everything turned black. When I was in the present, I was no longer in my bedroom. Everything looked different. I tried to look around the room, but I couldn't move my head. I couldn't move anything. Something was very wrong. Help! I screamed. Elizabeth walked in. She was no longer in a wheelchair. I was. She looked at me, annoyed. What is it this time? Do I need to clean you again?
My boyfriend Tommy was obsessed with the TV series Black Mirror. It's this really dark Netflix series all about how technology can go wrong and ruin people's lives. The episodes never ended happily, so it wasn't really my thing. Tommy loved it, though. I'd hear him watching it in the other room almost every night. His twin brother, Spencer, was also a big fan. When the new season came out last month, the two of them binged the whole thing together. They spent all night watching that dark show. I couldn't handle watching a whole episode of Black Mirror. Watching an entire season in one sitting? That sounded like torture to me. The day after their binge fest, Tommy tried to tell me all about his favorite episodes. I pretended to listen, but I really didn't. He got a little frustrated with me and said, "Just you wait. Some of those episodes will probably come true one day. With the way technology's advancing, it's only a matter of time." I just rolled my eyes and left the room. He was taking this fandom way too seriously. A few days later, I was on my computer when Tommy ran into my room with a panicked look on his face. "Rachel," he said, "don't do it!" Do what? I had no idea what he was talking about. He said he knew that I was going to hurt him, and he wanted to reason with me before it was too late. I asked him what the hell he was talking about. He pulled out his phone and showed me a new app that he'd downloaded. It was some sort of AI thing that answered questions about what was going to happen in the future. You just type in your name and a specific time, and it'll tell you what you'll be doing. He showed me the results for that evening. It said I was going to get really angry at him and attack him with a knife. I was speechless. How could he possibly believe something like that? It was obviously some kind of stupid joke. He looked deadly serious, though. It was like he believed that he was living in some sort of Black Mirror episode. "I'm not going to stab you," I assured him. "Trust me." He backed away, acting scared. "I think I'm going to stay at my brother's tonight," he said. This whole thing was ridiculous, obviously. I was not in the mood to deal with Tommy's paranoia. I snatched the phone out of his hands to prove that the app was made up. "Look," I said. I refreshed the app, and then I typed in my name and today's date. And then I waited for a response. It took 5 seconds for the app to respond. "You will stab your boyfriend at 6:15 tonight." "See," he said, "it's the truth." Obviously, this app was just joking with us. It probably predicted murder for all its users. I changed the time to 30 minutes in the future and tried again. After 5 seconds, the app replied, "You will be called into work to handle an emergency." "Okay," I said. "Let's wait 30 minutes. If my work doesn't call me, then we'll know that this app is nonsense." I was confident that nothing was going to happen. Today was Saturday, and my work never needed me to be there in person on the weekend. They'd have to pay me overtime, which is something my boss would never do. 30 minutes later, my phone rang. Tommy's eyes widened in horror. "Are you going to answer it?" he asked. I looked down at my phone and saw that it was the office calling. I answered it, and I listened to my boss ask if I could come into work. He said that our entire database had been deleted and they needed my help to recover the missing data. I knew it was just a dumb coincidence, but Tommy saw it as proof that the app was real, that I was going to stab him. He rushed into his closet, packed up a suitcase of clothes, and told me that he'd stay at Spencer's until the app told him that it was safe to come back. I felt like screaming at him. How could he be so gullible? No technology had the power to predict the future. Couldn't argue with him, though, because, well, he was already gone. Besides, I had to deal with my work emergency. I went to my office, and I spent the next few hours redoing all the work that I had done for the last month. It was so frustrating, but I was able to finish as much as I could. My boss still didn't know what caused us to lose all that data, but he promised me it wouldn't happen again. When I got back home, I was exhausted and angry. Tommy still wasn't back yet. I was alone, and I didn't know what to do with myself. I tried watching TV, but I kept thinking about that stupid app. I knew it wasn't real, but I couldn't stop thinking about it. So, eventually, I pulled out my phone and I went to the App Store to see if I could download it. I remembered the app's name and I found it right away. It was available to download for free, so I did. As it was loading, I saw that it was released yesterday. Didn't have any reviews yet, and the publisher was unlisted. And that's when I realized what had really happened. This app was a joke, after all. It was created by Spencer, Tommy's brother. Spencer was a computer genius with way too much time on his hands. He created this app to mess with his brother. I guess Black Mirror had inspired him. The app probably wasn't even connected to an AI engine. Spencer was probably typing the answers himself. Which means that he also sabotaged my work, using his computer skills to delete a bunch of files just so he could prove that the app could predict the future. I had wasted all day at work because of a prank. It was insane, and way too complicated. I had to figure out how to get back at him. I got a message on my phone saying that the app failed to download. I guess it was just made for Tommy. I got in my car and I drove straight to Spencer's house. I parked across the street so that he wouldn't see me, and then I snuck around to the side of the building. I could see Spencer and Tommy through the window. They were sitting together, talking about me. Tommy still seemed freaked out, and Spencer was trying to calm him down. He could barely hide his smirk. Very quietly, I walked to the next window, the one outside Spencer's office. When I looked inside, I saw his computer still running. I pushed the window open and crawled inside. Thankfully, Spencer had stupidly kept his screen on. I didn't know a lot about coding, but I could tell that he was still connected to his fake app. As I thought, no AI was involved. It was basically just a fancy-looking chat service where a user would type in a time, and then Spencer could manually type in a reply. That was it. That was how he could predict the future. I got onto his computer and started typing. I assumed that the message would pop up on Tommy's phone. I wrote, "Your future has changed. Now you will be attacked by your brother. He's in the room with you right now. Do not tell him that you suspect anything." Then I sent the message. I could hear Tommy's phone ding from the other room, and then I waited. I expected to hear Tommy freak out and run out of the house. I didn't expect to hear all the screaming and banging sounds. I opened the door to look into the living room, and I saw Tommy standing over his brother's body. He had a broken lamp in his hands. He had used it to hit Spencer on the head. This had gone way too far. I ran into the room and screamed for Tommy to stop. "What are you doing here?" he asked. I didn't answer. I didn't know what to say. I just stared at Spencer's body, twitching on the ground. He was going to kill me," Tommy explained, tears leaking from his eyes. I told him to put the lamp down. I tried to explain about the app, but he wouldn't believe me. I told him to look on Spencer's computer and see for himself. His face completely blank, he dropped the lamp and walked into Spencer's office. He was there for a while, probably looking at the computer screen. That gave me some time to call an ambulance for Spencer. I went into the office to find Tommy, but he wasn't there. The window was still open, and it looked like he'd made a run for it. I went back to Spencer, who was barely conscious and bleeding out of his ears. Together, we waited for the ambulance to arrive. I went with Spencer to the hospital, where the police were waiting for me. I told them all about the app, about how it was a prank that went horribly wrong. I said that Spencer would corroborate my story once he got out of the emergency room. Unfortunately, he never did. He slipped into a coma and is still unconscious. It's been 3 days, and no one knows where Tommy went. I hope that Spencer wakes up. I hope that Tommy will reappear somewhere. But for now, I have no idea what to do with myself. I feel so guilty about how things turned out. Everything started to go downhill on the fifth day, when Cindy called Raphael a greedy bastard because he ate more portions than the rest of us. It was freezing cold outside, she said as part of her rant, in the middle of winter, and none of us boys would brave the cold for supplies. She maintained that she had watched Raphael take more beer and food than the rest of us, and she'd had enough of it because it meant that the rest of us would starve when we ran out of supplies. It was not the will to drive out that was the problem. It was the fact that we could not, I reasoned from what she said. The snow on the path from our winter vacation abode to the nearest store was at least knee-deep. It was too much work, and we had calculated all of the heavy snowfall in our shopping. What we had not calculated was Raphael's heavy appetite. It was a moment of outburst that I had particularly noted because of the marked change in Raphael's demeanor when those words had been uttered. He had been quiet at first in reaction to it, and then his eyes had fallen to a squint of consideration to manage his seething rage. His arms twitched, his anger still managed, though. He sighed and examined the portion of food he was being insulted over. He heaved to exhale, and the mist of the winter cold escaped his nostrils. I sensed something had changed when Raphael dropped the plate onto the table and turned to Carl, who held Cindy in his arms, his new girlfriend, whom he had insisted come with us boys to the vacation home against our better judgment. "Is this what you think of me, Carl?" Raphael asked with a look of puzzlement on his face. Then he turned to me. "Doug?" Carl sighed and leaned into his girlfriend. He stared at her face and shrugged.
"He's had 4 bottles of beer, and it's barely noon. We have had none."
Cindy's smart mouth let off.
"Anybody who wants more beer, pick the keys and brave the cold to go get beers."
Cindy, I had had enough of the awful way she spoke to Raphael. The tension in the atmosphere was understandable, and I was slightly offended by the silence Carl maintained when his girlfriend went off on Raphael like that. Suddenly, Raphael grinned and stood up from where he sat. He stared at all three of us, Carl, me, and Cindy, and spoke without missing a beat. "Maybe there are too many of us and too little resources. It'd be a shame if some of us had to leave," he said cryptically. And with that, he left us in the living room and ambled around the cabin to his room. I did not see Raphael for the rest of the day, and I did not check in on him as I had no idea of the evil that had reared its head and now brewed over our small group. It was not until late in the night, when I was cozying up in the warmth of the thick blanket for the winter, that the strange noise woke me up. The cry was desperate and pleading, and it had penetrated so deep into my dreams that when I woke up, I spent a few seconds investigating whether it had been imagined or real. It wasn't long before I clocked out the source of the cry and the familiar voices behind it. The hairs on my skin stood on edge. I rushed off my bed and scrimmaged through my door towards Carl and Cindy's room.
"Please! Ah, my fucking arm!" Carl cried in a grave tone that turned my stomach. "You've chopped my arms up, you bastard!"
The crying grew louder and more desperate as I approached the room, and my haste faltered to a slow, careful march towards the door. Wild chomping sounds followed the closer I got, and I flinched at how violent it sounded. Carl's cry horrified me because it spoke of death. Between the cold from the winter and the cold from sheer panic, I could not tell which paralyzed me the most. My mind turned to Raphael. He had to be in his own room, too. My head spun. What was happening? The question in my head was a difficult one to answer. Was there an intruder in the house? A murderous intruder? How could an intruder have found us in the middle of winter? What did the intruder want? A piece of my mind instinctively cried for escape, but my legs were too heavy to carry me through, and the cold outside would kill me quicker than any murderer could. I had only one thought in my head, and it was to return to fetch my pistol. I hurried back to my room as stealthily as I could, and Carl's screams faded the farther I got, until all was quiet. I retrieved my gun and stepped outside my door, ready to defend myself and Raphael, if he was still alive, from whatever murderous spree whoever was in the house was on. To my utmost horror, it was Raphael who was on the other side of the passageway, dripping in blood, with a bloody pickaxe in one hand. He looked at me with a wicked grin on his face and turned towards me. "Well, I did say there were too many of us and too little resources," he shrugged whimsically. Shame it had to be them. Raphael's audacity stunned me. I had been friends with him for 3 years, and I had no idea he had it in him to butcher his friends in cold blood and show a total lack of remorse about it. He maintained cold indifference to what he had done, and perhaps it was that which terrified me the most. I wanted nothing more in the world than for what I had just witnessed to be a horrible dream that I woke up from afterwards with a feverish sweat, but it was not. "Do you have a problem with my rations?" Raphael asked me, slowly making his way towards me as the blood dripped from the tip of the pickaxe to the floor. The world around me blurred, and my mind was dizzy from having to process how much danger I was in. My fingers on the trigger shook as I reached the decision when Raphael's demeanor turned from casual to menacing. "Ah!" he roared as he approached me to finish me off, just as he had done to Carl and Cindy. I pulled out the weapon I had on me and watched his eyes light up in fright when he faced death himself. My gun banged, and it caught him straight to the forehead. The pickaxe dropped from his hands and banged on the floor, just as Raphael's limp body did. The house was suddenly quiet, and my horror ended with my heart thrashing wildly in my chest. I rushed towards the room where Cindy and Carl stayed, witnessing a bloody mess that burned my stomach. I fell to my knees and cried when I realized how futile calling emergency services would be, as it would be meaningless to drive the cold night through a heap of snow to clean up already dead bodies. My name is Luke, and this all happened to me years ago, back when Snapchat didn't have all the features it does now. Back then, my friends and I used it to share jokes and memes. We sent each other some really stupid stuff because we knew that whenever we sent, it would disappear right after. Out of everyone in my group, my friend Johnny used Snapchat the most. Every day, he'd send me at least a dozen different things. It was honestly too much, but I didn't have the heart to tell him. Then spring break happened. It was our senior year, and I just stayed with my parents. Johnny's family was pretty rich, though, so he drove by himself to Lake Havasu to spend the week partying. He used his older brother's ID to buy alcohol. He didn't know anyone else in Lake Havasu, but that didn't stop Johnny. He was a free spirit. I assumed his spring break was going well, because right after he left, he stopped sending me anything on Snapchat. I sent him a couple things, and I texted him to ask how he was doing, but he didn't respond. I wasn't too worried about it, until I got a single message from him 4 days into his trip. It happened at 3 in the morning. I opened my phone, and I saw that he'd sent me a photo of a dirty old trailer in the middle of the desert, looked really sketchy. At the bottom of the photo was a Lake Havasu address. There was no other information. The image disappeared and I went back to sleep. At the time, I assumed that he was at some underground rave or something. I figured that the next day my phone would be filled with photos of him dancing with the glow sticks. But the next day, Johnny didn't send me anything. By that time, I started to get worried. Was something wrong with him? Why did he send me a random address? I called up a couple of my friends, and they said that they got the same photo. Three of us gathered at my house to figure it out. We talked for a while. Maybe Johnny was pulling some prank on us, but that didn't sound like him. He always sent really stupid stuff, but nothing like this, nothing this cryptic. Together, we realized that he might have been asking for help. Maybe he was trapped there. Maybe he needed us to come rescue him. The trailer definitely didn't look like anywhere that Johnny would purposely want to visit. We decided that we'd get into my car and drive all the way to Lake Havasu to find him. Because the image had disappeared, we didn't have the exact address. I remember that the street was called Mesquite, but none of us could think of the house number. It ended with 32. I got on my laptop and opened MapQuest, which was how we found out directions back then. We saw that Mesquite was a dirt road just outside of Lake Havasu. It was in the middle of the desert, just like that picture. I told my parents that we'd be gone for the day, and then we drove 6 hours from my house in California to Lake Havasu. The city itself looked pretty fun. A lot of young people were partying on the lake and walking on the sidewalk. If I weren't so nervous about my friend, I would have liked to go exploring. Then we got off the main roads and pulled onto Mesquite. The road was more difficult than I'd expected. I was glad I had a four-wheel drive. After 20 minutes on that road, we'd passed just a couple run-down trailers, but none that looked like the picture Johnny had sent us. I was starting to lose hope. And then Trevor, one of my friends in the back seat, leaned forward and said, "I think that's the one." He pointed towards a small brown structure in the distance. It was the trailer from the picture. It looked even worse in person. It just sat by itself with no other cars nearby. I parked in front, and then the three of us just waited in silence. "So what do we do?" I asked. "Do we all go in together?" Trevor said that we should. But my other friend, Luke, argued that one of us should stay in the car just in case. Since I was the driver, I'd stay behind. Honestly, I was fine with that. The place really gave me the creeps. I got my phone out, ready to call 911 if there were any signs of trouble. I saw that my phone had just one bar, so the signal wasn't great out here, but I'd have to make it work. Slowly, my two friends got out of the car and walked towards the trailer. I watched them anxiously. They made it to the already open front door and knocked. When no one answered, they disappeared inside. After about 5 minutes, I started getting really worried. They weren't coming out. Something must have happened. I tried to call 911, but my phone wouldn't connect. The signal was too weak. I'd have to go in there myself. I made sure the car was locked, and I walked towards the trailer. I could feel my heart pounding. I didn't know whether I should be quiet or shout out their names. I decided to be quiet. I reached the front door and looked inside. The trailer was empty, and there were no other exits. It only had one door, and all the windows were closed. I didn't want to go inside, but I knew I had to. So, I just stuck my head in and looked around. Aside from some broken down furniture, there was nothing inside, and there were no signs of my friends. I had no idea what to do now. Where had they possibly gone? I was done being quiet, so I called out their names. No one answered. I walked around the trailer to see if there was something hidden behind it, but all I could see was rolling desert. Everything was really quiet. I got back in my car and drove into town. The police station was off the main road, so I went in and explained what had happened. I probably sounded crazy, The officer I talked to seemed pretty sympathetic, but I could tell that he didn't believe my story. I told him that we needed to go back there together and search for them. As we left the station, I received two notifications on my phone. Now that I had a signal again, I'd gotten two separate Snapchat messages from each of my friends. With the officer right next to me, I showed him the messages. They'd each sent the same photo as Johnny. The officer took one look and realized that I was telling the truth. We got in his cop car and drove on to Mesquite. We drove for miles, but neither of us could spot the trailer. It was like it had never been there. The officer even radioed the station to ask about the address, but the lady on dispatch said that there was no such address in their records. We got back to the station without any answers. The officer made me fill in a report, and he said that he'd let me know if anything turned up. This all happened a decade ago, and I never saw my friends again. I still think about them a lot. I know this sounds crazy, but there's got to be a logical explanation that I'm just not seeing. I don't know. I still hold up hope that one day they'll come back. I don't use Snapchat anymore, but I still have it on my phone, just in case Johnny or the others message me.